Okay. Well, when I was asked to give this talk, I warned them that it would be a close shave. I've been going in and out of town. Both my wife and I are participants in the workshop on galaxy clusters, and so we've been swapping places. So I got here 10 minutes ago. Well, 15 now. So hi everybody. How you been? 2 months ago, there was another Blackboard talk, associated workshop near the beginning of the workshop, done by Gus Everard from University of Michigan. And it was about the cosmological aspects of galaxy clusters. Our workshop is about the intersection of astrophysics and cosmology. And while I'm going to try to focus more on the astrophysics in this talk, the two things really are inseparable, and that's part of what makes clusters interesting. They are very much in tune with what's going along cosmologically. They grow, and the growth rate is really governed by the overall makeup of the universe. But as we focus in more and more, we find there's lots of interesting astrophysics going on that we'll need to understand in order to do precision cosmology by measuring galaxy clusters. So I was supposed to give a title. I gave Astrophysics of Galaxy Clusters. I should have given Galaxy Clusters in a Nutshell. That occurred to me over the weekend. But you can think of it like that if you want. The first thing I want to just mention, or start with, a fresh piece of talk is what is a cluster of galaxies? So it seems like an obvious question, but most of what a galaxy cluster is can't easily be seen by the naked eye. So a galaxy cluster, first, is a bunch of galaxies in space. So I'll draw some galaxies here. I'm drawing them like spirals because that's what looks like a galaxy. But actually, most of the galaxies in a galaxy cluster, or a lot of them, are elliptical galaxies. And then there's usually often a dominant one at the center, the central galaxy of the cluster, and that's often the brightest one. All in all, there's about a order 10 to the 3 galaxies in a galaxy cluster, especially a large one. And they're spread over a region of space that is maybe 3 megaparsecs from side to side. And I realized we astrophysicists like to talk about things in parsecs, but a lot of you probably aren't used to parsecs. If I use light years, is that going to be a little bit better? Okay. We'll try light. So I'll apologize to my astrophysicist colleagues. I'm going to be going with light years a lot, and that might make things look strange, but might make them a little more easy to understand. This is about 10 mega light years. Okay. So 10 million years for light to travel across a galaxy cluster. When we try to measure the spectra of these galaxies, we see that they're redshifted with respect to one another. That means they're moving towards or away from us along the line of sight within the frame of the galaxy cluster. And the motions of the galaxies imply a mass of like 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15 times the mass of the Sun. Okay. So there's a lot of mass that's associated with this galaxy cluster, gravitationally binding it together. And the stars that we see in these galaxies are only about 1/50th of the gravitating mass in the galaxy cluster. So there's a lot in here that we're not seeing when we're just seeing the galaxies of the cluster. And this has been known since, well, the tradition of this goes back to the 1930s with Fritz Zwicky. Dark matter might sound like a fairly recent subject, but in fact, the first evidence for dark matter in the universe came from studies of galaxy clusters almost 80 years ago. Okay. In the 1970s, when we started to get X-ray observatories in space, we found that galaxy clusters are also powerful X-ray sources. And that's because there's lots of hot gas in between the galaxies. At temperatures of 10 to 100 million degrees. I'm going to be talking about these temperatures mostly in terms of particle energy. So the 10 to 100 million degrees is like 1 to 10 keV in particle energy. So I'll be mostly using particle energies and talking about temperatures. And the X-ray imaging tells us that the amount of gas in the cluster is much greater than the amount of gas in, amount of mass in stars. M gas is something like 1/7 of the gravitating mass. So that's progress. We found some of the gravitating mass by looking in a different wave band, but the rest of it is dark. Okay, we haven't been able to see it in any other wave band, and that's why we call it dark matter. I'm not trying to be obscure. That's really a term that expresses our ignorance about what's there. So when you look at a galaxy cluster, it's about 2% stars and galaxies. about 13% in hot gas, and about 85% is dark. And a lot of, well, one good reason to study galaxy clusters is get a handle on just what the dark matter content of the universe is. Okay, now.
The fraction of the hot gas and the dark matter is bound in individual galaxies, distinct from being bound.
Okay, it's a question, okay. So the hot gas is not bound in galaxies. It's too hot to be bound in gravitational potential well. So
I'm just wondering how much it.
When we get to how much of the dark matter is associated with individual galaxies as opposed to associated with the cluster, that's a somewhat ambiguous question. A galaxy starts out with a halo of dark matter it sits in, but when it gets into the cluster, that starts to get tidally stripped. Okay, so the dark matter the galaxy started with starts to be eaten away and then gets incorporated into the cluster as a whole. So the question becomes that how do you define what belongs to the galaxy as opposed to what belongs to the cluster? Let's see. There's corroborating evidence that these masses are correct. Some of it comes from gravitational lensing. Okay. And so you've probably seen some spectacular pictures from Hubble showing when you look at a galaxy cluster, you see lots of distorted images of galaxies in the background from which we can measure how much matter is in the cluster. That gives similar numbers for mass to these two methods. And a more recent method is something called the Sanyao-Zagowicz effect, which is scattering of the cosmic white wave background. So the early universe left behind this radiation that we've been used to see what the universe is like, what kind of structures were present early in time. And when that radiation comes through the galaxy cluster, the hot electrons in this hot gas atmosphere will scatter the photons, often scatter them, and on average, they'll scatter them to higher energies. And that creates a distortion in the black body spectrum of the microwave background. And so we can observe these distortions as specks on the microwave sky. You want you can think of them as freckles on the face of God, if you remember the expression from Kobe now 20 years ago. Imagine that, almost 20 years ago. So this is now a new and rapidly growing way of measuring much of what the X-ray imaging shows us, but it's a more powerful way to measure the properties of galaxy clusters that are quite distant from us, because this effect is independent of distance, whereas the X-rays we receive go down with distance. Okay, so this is one of the big frontiers in studying galaxy clusters. To give you an idea of how this relates to the rest of the universe around it, I calculated some numbers. The average mass density of the universe can be expressed as 10 to the 9 solar masses per mega light year. Okay. So what that means is that the region from which this matter came is of order 100 megalight years across. So this thing has collapsed by about a factor of 10. Okay, the region of the universe that gravity has drawn in matter by about a factor of 10, making its density contrast with the rest of the universe about 1,000 times greater on average. Depends on where you define the edge of the cluster, but this is a clump of matter that's about 1,000 times greater than the average in the universe. Okay.
The distance
to the nearest cluster. It depends a lot on what mass threshold you put in. In order to contain, well, at the high mass end, you need a box that's almost a gigalight year across to have a few of these in it. Okay. So they really, when you get the high mass end, they really are pretty rare objects. Within the whole horizon that we can see, there may be about 10,000 objects of this mass range, about 100,000 of this mass. Another way to look at it is if you say, suppose I divide the universe into chunks that are this massive, how frequently do I get a chunk that's done this? At this mass range, it's less than 1% of them have actually formed this big an aggregation of stuff. Here it's a few percent. So maybe of order 5% of the universe is collected into galaxy clusters like this.
Are those numbers consistent with simulations of large-scale structure?
Yes, they are. That's not a coincidence.
People do
they fiddle with the parameters of large-scale structure until they get the numbers about right.
There's some parameters.
Now, while that sounds it might sound a little like cheating, the good thing is that there is a very well-defined model for expressing what the initial perturbations in the universe should have been like. And they do give clustered statistics naturally that come out like this. So it's a very consistent picture, but yes, it's not a coincidence. All right, how do they form? This kind of leads on to your question. How do clusters form? Okay, early in time, you can go back we can't go back, but we can use instruments that can see at least down out to the era of recombination. We can look for density fluctuations in the universe, and we can express a slight mass perturbation in terms of something we call delta. Okay. So in the universe, there are places early on where there's a little less mass than average, a little more mass than average, and where there's more mass than average, gravity will collect those things into objects. Okay. And the initial fluctuations, all the evidence indicates that they're Gaussian, so they can be expressed by some sort of variance at a given mass scale. And the probability of having a certain fluctuation is just an a Gaussian function. Okay, and what we find when we look at these fluctuations is that they are more subtle on large scales than they are on small scales. Okay, so the universe on large scales is almost homogeneous, and as you start looking at smaller and smaller scales, the fluctuations get greater. Also, because of gravity, these fluctuations grow with time. And the growth rate depends on how much matter there is in the universe. The more matter there is, the more stronger gravity is. But if there's also a cosmological constant or other kind of effect that's accelerating the expansion, that tends to compete against gravity. So by looking at the population of clusters and how they evolve, that gives us information and constraints on how much matter there is and how strong whatever repulsive force might be producing the expansion is becoming. Okay. Okay. You might ask, why is why are the fluctuations getting more subtle as you go to higher and higher masses? One reason is if you look at potential fluctuations, they're like the gravitational potential. You associate that with that given unit of mass times the fluctuation. And if I look at the universe at any given time, I can express the radius of something as mass over density to the 1/3 power. And that indicates that these potential fluctuations go like mass to the 2/3 power on the mass scale I'm looking at times delta m over m. And what that means is if I have a power law distribution, unless delta m over m is something like mass to the minus 2/3 power, these potential fluctuations will diverge either on large scales or small scales. So early in time, the most natural distribution to put in is one where delta m over m goes like mass to the minus 2/3 power. And that is indeed what we see at large scales when we look at the microwave background fluctuation. Right? On smaller scales, there's other physics that comes in to make that a little less mass dependent, a little less strong, but it's still such that when we look at the perturbations, they're larger on small scales, more subtle on large scales. And what that implies is that structure formation is hierarchical, right? As time goes on, first the small things will go nonlinear and collapse, then they'll collect into bigger things, and so on and so on. If we look at the universe, it's at a scale of about 10 to the 14 solar masses. these fluctuations of our water unity. And that's what makes galaxy clusters a very interesting place to look. They are just forming in the last half of cosmic history. And they're telling us that we're looking at the transition from nonlinear behavior, from linear behavior to nonlinear behavior in the gravitational structure formation. And the very most massive clusters are at the tail of this Gaussian distribution of fluctuations. So a little bit of change in the evolution of the universe produces large numbers of, a large number change in the counts at high mass. So galaxy clusters are potentially a very sensitive probe of how the universe, how structure in the universe is growing. Okay. The trick, though, is to do this, to really get a handle on this precision, we need to be able to measure cluster masses very accurately. Okay? And that's a lot of what our workshop has been about, is how do you go about measuring cluster mass accurately enough to tap the rich cosmological information that's contained in this cluster mass distribution.
One more question, Peter.
Yeah.
Is it the reason you don't see really huge black holes at the center of the clusters where everything might fall in, say, 100 billion solar masses, because we just haven't had enough time?
We're going to get to black holes.
Okay.
Black holes may make a big difference in what's going on in the centers of clusters. Okay, so stay tuned. We'll get to that soon. Okay, so how do we measure mass? I covered this a little bit already, but I thought I'd give you a few relationships that we use. Okay, so the first thing to look at is a cosmologist's ideal cluster. I'm going to stress the word ideal because this is not really how they are, but it's how we might hope they are. Okay. The velocities in a gravitationally balanced system are going to be related to the gravitational potential, and that would imply that velocity should be proportional to mass to the 2/3 power times density to the 1/3 power. Okay, and if we're measuring X-ray temperature, so in this X-ray imaging, we can do spectroscopy and determine the temperature of the gas. Okay. We might expect then the X-ray temperature to be proportional to mass to the 2/3 times density to the 1/3. We can also expect the gas mass is just proportional to the total mass, or the mass in stars is proportional to the total mass. That would be useful. I can also look at the X-ray luminosity of this stuff. Now, what produces X-ray luminosity? Much of it is free emission. So there are collisions, particle collisions, that either create free emission, or if you still have ions with bound electrons in this gas this hot, it can excite emission, line emission. So it's like the volume of the cluster times the density squared, because we're looking at collisional processes, two-body collision. And then some function that depends on temperature, which for free emission is like temperature to the 1/2 power. So if you run that through, expect X-ray luminosity to be proportional to the mass times the density times temperature to the 1/2. But that is like temperature squared times density to the minus 1/2. Okay. Another thing of interest when we're looking at the scattering of microwave background, that depends on the total thermal energy of the cluster, which is often expressed as Y, that's the gas mass, times the temperature. And that is proportional to mass to the 5/3 power times rho to the 1/3. And these are the relations we're hoping to use to actually measure masses of clusters using this kind of information.
But the belief is the density is more or less constant?
I will get to that question in just a second. What's implicit here in a lot of these relations, in particular the Fourier relation, is I've chosen an average density for the cluster. When I make this choice, I'm defining a cluster radius to be something within which the density of the cluster, on average, is some multiple of the critical density of the universe, the matter density required to cause these stuff to turn around. So when temperatures are going to be related to that density. But when I'm talking about X-ray emission, I'm talking about the gas temperature and the gas density. And that turns out to be not self-similar. So you're anticipating where I'm going. real clusters. If we observe them, we find things like X-ray luminosity is proportionate to temperature cubed, roughly. We find that the gas mass is not, as a fraction of the total, goes down as we look at smaller systems. Okay. If we look at the mass in stars as a fraction of the total, we find that goes up. Okay. So while this would have been great if it all worked perfectly, we find that this is not a self-similar population of objects. Okay. Gas physics shows that there's other things we need to consider now. And that's what makes things interesting. So I know particle physicists often talk about how symmetry is something that's very beautiful. Hubble pictures are also very beautiful. But they're beautiful because they're complex. Okay. So it can also be interesting to study the physics of complex systems. And this is a very deep rabbit hole. We get down to galaxy clusters and galaxy formation within clusters. And I'll try to keep it simple, but it's going to get more and more complicated. Okay, so what breaks similarity? Okay, well, all these relationships haven't really yet taken account for the fact that there's galaxies here. Galaxies were made during the process of cluster formation, or even before the cluster was assembled, galaxies were made. And so when galaxies are made, there's radiative cooling that happens. You make stars, some of those stars explode, and you can put energy back into the surroundings when that happens. Quick question. Astronomers can't answer this question. So what happens if you have now a self-gravitating cloud of gas, and it starts to lose thermal energy by radiating it away? Okay, what happens to its temperature? It goes up. Okay. So what? When you have a self-gravitating system, it has a negative specific heat. And that means if we're trying to figure out whether you've put energy into this system or taken it out, we can't really focus on temperature. Okay. What we need to focus on is actually the entropy content of the gas. And so I can write down this formula. You probably saw as a freshman, okay, where the change in entropy of gas is like the change in heat energy divided by temperature. There's a quantity that cluster astrophysicists call entropy sometimes. It's a misnomer. It is the adiabatic constant between pressure and density. So if you have a gas in which entropy isn't changing, and it's a monatomic ideal gas, then this quantity will stay constant, okay, if you compress the gas or let it expand. And you can measure this with an X-ray telescope because you can measure temperature and density. This is proportional to kT times electron density to the minus 2/3 power. Okay. Another way of looking at this quantity, if we take k to the minus 3/2 power, that's proportional to the particle density times the velocity to the minus 3. That's a phase space density. So it's like another form of expressing the phase space density of particles. Now, we can also take this phase space density, and we can, I won't write that down, but if we multiply it by h cubed, what we find is it's about, again, a number something like 10 to the minus 30. Okay. So, if that were water unity, it would be a degenerate system. This is 10 to the minus 30 away. It makes it the least degenerate gas in the universe. So, in case you're wondering what this quantity is tracking, it's tracking how far you are from being degenerate. And this is the farthest you can get from being a degenerate gas in the universe. Okay. So, how does this develop in a galaxy cluster? It develops during the process of assembly. Gravity is bringing these blobs of dark matter together. Gas is getting pulled along. There are shocks that happen, and it's turning the energy of infall into heat energy, and that's what's producing the entropy of the gas in the cluster. So if we try to model that in a structure formation simulation, we find that the entropy you get is proportional to mass to the 2/3 times density to the minus 1/3. And it's something that, if we look at an individual cluster, tends to increase with radius, because the low entropy gas is easily compressed, and that's not buoyant. It sinks to the center. The high entropy gas floats to the outside. And this power law is reflective of the assembly history of the cluster. Okay. When we ask whether gas can condense and form galaxies, we have to compare the rate at which it's radiatively cooling, the rate at which it's heating up, or at very least the time it's had to sit around at a given entropy level. And what we find is, the densest gas can radiate most easily, so you tend to remove the lowest entropy gas first. It gets segregated from the rest of the cluster, and that's what forms the galaxies. And if we just remove that stuff and look at the cluster, so we say adding gas cooling and condensation, and what we get is clusters where LX is roughly proportional to T cubed, and the rest of these relations also come to pass, which sounds like good news until you look at how many stars formed. Okay. If you just allow gas to cool and form stars, you find a number over here that is two or four times higher than the number of stars you actually see, depending on the details of how the simulation's done. This is one of the central problems of galaxy formation in general, is known as the overcooling problem. If you just allow gas to cool and the structure formation happen, you end up with too many stars. And so a great deal of effort in the community has gone into how to prevent this from happening, understanding what prevents it from happening. And one of the main candidates is the supernova explosions that occur when you start to assemble a galaxy and make stars. They release a lot of energy and have the potential to stop cooling from happening at this kind of scale. How do we simulate galaxy formation? If you want to simulate these really massive galaxy clusters, in order to get just a few of them in your simulation volume, you need a really big volume because they're rare. So you make a really big box in your computer, and you put in dark matter and gas and gravity and hydro, some kind of hydrodynamic prescription, and allow cooling to happen. Okay. But to get a few monsters like this, your box needs to be about 10 of a million light years on a side. Okay. How big is a galaxy? A galaxy is about 10 to the 5 light years, at least the part where the stars are. Okay. How big is a star forming region? Star forming region is maybe 10 light years on a side. Okay. So we have a big scale problem here. Galaxies are 10 to the 4 times smaller than the box. The star forming regions are tiny within the galaxies. This problem we can handle somewhat using mesh refinement techniques. Okay. So there's techniques known as adaptive mesh refinement, where as you start to condense somewhere on the grid, you keep refining the mesh so you can keep doing the calculation, focus your computational effort on that little piece. There's another technique known as smooth particle hydrodynamics, where you treat all the fluid elements here as essentially interacting particles, and as they collect together, that automatically increases the refinement in the region where you need it. Okay, and that can do an okay job of getting to this level. Okay, but you can't get to this level. So what you need to put in are subgrid prescriptions for the reaction star formation, call this gravitation and cooling, right? And this is where potentially a lot of magic can occur, right? So this is an area of active research, but it's hard to do precisely, clearly. What about supernova feedback? And I'm looking at the time and looking at my notes. I will not draw it all on the board, but I'll tell you how you can estimate what the effect of supernova feedback might be. From the spectra you get from X-ray imaging, you can figure out what the iron content is of the gas. You can figure out what the oxygen content of this gas, and that's produced by supernova explosions and expelled by galaxies into the cluster. In a supernova explosion, you know how much energy you get out, kinetic energy, per unit iron mass or per unit oxygen mass. So your pollutants, your iron and oxygen, are an indicator of how much supernova energy could have gone in to the intercluster medium. The supernovae, they can contribute a little less than a keV per nucleon. Okay. And that is only if the supernova energy is very efficiently transferred to the surrounding medium. Now, in fact, when supernovae occur in star-forming regions, there's a lot of dense gas around. If that energy gets coupled to that dense gas, it can all get radiated away, and it won't do much good trying to pump energy into the intercluster medium, as we see we need to do. We need to stop overcooling from happening. So this is like the most optimistic scenario. Okay. It will have a big impact on things that are a little smaller than this mass scale. But once you get up to these monsters, you're talking about certainly less than 10% effect and maybe only a few percent effect of thermal energy of the gas. We had the question about black holes. What about supermassive black holes? I'm trying to figure out what to take away now. I think I will take away this one. So this is going to be an abbreviation for supermassive black holes. Okay. From observations, we know that the mass of a supermassive black hole, the center of a galaxy, is of order a 0.5% of the mass of stars in the bulge. Okay, it's an observational finding. What's interesting about that, this proportionality indicates that the galaxy, the evolution of a galaxy, is closely linked to the evolution of the black hole at its center. Now, we can make these measurements only for nearby galaxies where you can resolve the center well enough to measure the motions of matter around the central black hole. And it's hard to do once you get farther out. But these central galaxies in clusters have masses of about 10 to 12 solar masses. That's in stars alone. So BCG stands for brightest cluster galaxy. And that's about 10 to 12 solar masses. Okay. So when we multiply this out, we expect the mass of a supermassive black hole in a brightest cluster galaxy to be of order 5 times 10 to 9 solar masses. Okay. And in fact, in the nearest galaxy cluster, the Virgo cluster, there's a galaxy called M87, and that's actually had a measured black hole mass, and it's, the original numbers said 3 times 10 to the 9, now the latest one says 6 times 10 to the 9. So we can't measure these for all clusters, or even many of them, but the very nearest ones, this seems to hold. There's a supermassive black hole, quite impressive mass, at the center of the galaxy cluster. How much power can we get out of it? In general, when a supermassive black hole accretes matter, it has to lose a lot of angular momentum. That happens in what we call an accretion disk. And in an accretion disk, you expect to transform about 10% of the accreting rest mass energy into either radiation or kinetic power. And in this case, that's about 10 to the 63 ergs, and I know I'm showing my astronomer roots by not using joules. This enables them to check my work. Okay. Just as an aside, that's the same amount of kinetic energy that you get from 10 to the 12th supernovae. I know when I talk to my I'm from Michigan State. Nuclear physics is real big there. They're very impressed by supernovae. And I was giving a talk when I started pulling numbers like this out. I said, is that a typo? Because they think supernovae are really powerful. Well, compared to supermassive black holes, not so much. Okay. If you now take that energy and divide it by the gas mass that you see in a massive galaxy cluster, that's of order 5 keV per nucleon. And again, this is the most optimistic scenario. This is saying somehow I took this accretion power and I was able to transform it all into kinetic energy in this big surrounding gas pile. Okay. So it says, you know, if this can happen, it can have a pretty dramatic effect even on the most massive systems. Okay. Well, one of the really fun things that's been going on in the last decade in galaxy cluster research is trying to understand these interactions between supermassive black holes and the surrounding gas. And it gives us a great opportunity to actually see how feedback processes work. For most galaxies in the universe, when we try to image the gas that's around them, it's not emitting enough for us to do a good job on that. Their gas is too cool to pick up an X-ray telescope, and it looks like if we try to do that, it also looks like a lot of it has been ejected or pushed out to larger radii, because we don't see very much signal. But in a galaxy cluster, we get lots of X-ray signal to see what the gas is like outside of galaxies and see how these interactions actually work. Okay. So when we do X-ray imaging of, say, now the central 10 to the 5 light years, what was my abbreviation for light year? There's not a standard one. I guess I've been switching back and forth. That's supposed to be a light year. Okay. Well, there's the area of the central galaxy where the black hole is, and then there are lobes of emission around it that have, there's radio signal from synchrotron emission in these lobes. That's been known for a while. But with the Chandra X-ray telescope, about 10 years ago, we started imaging the X-rays in detail around here with high spatial resolution and found that they evacuate cavities. Okay, so there's an outflow of relativistic matter into the surrounding area, surrounding volume, that's pushing away the X-ray gas. So there's X-rays here, there's radio here, okay? And if you just estimate the energy content of these cavities by measuring the pressure with your X-ray information and measuring a volume from the X-ray information, you get that there's of order 10 to the 59 ergs in one of these bubbles. And this can vary a lot depending on the size of the system you're in. But this is a typical number. Okay. Then you can also ask the question, well, how long has this been going on? Can I transform this number into a power? Well, if I've inflated a cavity here, it's going to be buoyant, and it's going to want to float away. And we can estimate a buoyancy time. And the buoyancy time, typical time scale is about 10 to 15 seconds, or the 30 million years. If you divide these numbers, you get a power of something like 10 to the 44 ergs per second, which is in the same order of magnitude as the X-ray luminosity from this region. Okay, so that leads to a plausibility argument that's not a proof. It looks like the rate at which energy is coming out of this central region of the central galaxy is at least the same order of magnitude as the cooling rate of its surroundings. Okay, that's about as far as I can go with a plausibility argument without really going down a rabbit hole. It's an area of active research to try to figure out how this energy couples to the surrounding gas. Okay, if all you do is inflate a balloon and let it rise, You haven't necessarily taken that balloon energy and transferred it into thermal energy in the surrounding medium. If the bubble rises, and as it rises, gas is falling around it and starting to excite waves, and you get turbulence and dissipation, you can thermalize some of that energy. Or if the cosmic rays that are in here, because that's essentially what you have in here, if they can leak out and start to couple with the surrounding gas, that can couple the energy. But I think one of the real puzzles is not only how do you get this energy to couple in detail, but how the system ends up being tuned in the first place, if it is indeed finely tuned. Because the supermassive black hole, well, the supermassive black hole itself is about a light day in radius. The accreting zone around it may be a light year in radius. And somehow it seems to be stopping cooling in a region that's 10 to the 5 light years in size. Okay. I think, I don't know if anybody wants to disagree with me, but this is a very interesting problem. How do things manage to get so well balanced with a vast range of time scales and size scales that are involved?
How many examples are there?
How many examples?
This one.
Of these?
Yeah.
Actually, okay, I'll make two remarks. One is some clusters have pretty short central cooling times. By short, I mean less than a percent of the age of the universe, meaning if you let it go, you know, get cooling condensation right away. Every single one of those also shows cavities. Okay, so there's a definite circumstantial connection between having a problem with cooling and apparent solution in the AGN, or the, I'm using jargon, the energy output from the central engine. Okay. The trick to knowing whether it's balanced is actually accurately measuring the energy input. You know, if you can do it to a factor of 4, well, either that's 25% too much, or too little, or 4 times too much, right? So that is something we're trying to work on. But the fact
what about
that
the other 1,000 galaxies in their black hole?
It's a good question. There's a lot of potential black hole energy still involved in these things. The thing is that they're not right at the center where the cooling is actually happening. Okay, so they could also, in principle, put out energy, but it doesn't create the tight feedback loop you need in order to stop cooling where it's mostly most acute problem. Okay. So to back up.
Why is it? They're not as massive.
They're less massive. Well,
there are 1,000.
There are 1,000 of them.
They're in S dense regions.
Yeah. Well, there are two issues going on. One is a timing issue. So what's likely is a lot of these black holes formed long before the cluster. Okay, the era of quasars in the universe was from maybe 1 to 4 gigayears, and then tailed off. Okay, the cluster probably formed after 4 gigayears. So whatever energy they had to put out was probably put in earlier than that. It may still affect what the cluster is like now. But what I'm referring to right now is the present-day cooling problem, where you look at the center of a galaxy cluster, you find gas that is dense and has a short central cooling time. And so in order to stop that from cooling and forming stars, you need a heat source right there at the center of it. So that's why I'm focusing on it. And yes, there could be a lot more energy input from these others earlier in the history of the cluster. So this is one area of active research. Now we can really start looking under the rug and asking, is the fluid approximation valid? So these simulations assume the fluid approximation is valid. And there's a lot of simulations of this nature that assume the fluid approximation is valid. But if you ask, what's the mean free path of a particle in their cluster medium, it's about 1 to 10%. Of the radius that you're at in the cluster, okay? Which means there's the potential for
lots of cooling.
Pardon? Coulombic path, yeah. Wow, yes. I'm getting to that. Yeah. So if you just naively ask, suppose this is magnetic field free, how far would particle travel? What you get is a pretty long distance compared to the radius. You'd wonder why these boundaries are so sharp if the mean free path is so long. You wonder whether your simulation that has a very low viscosity is realistic. Okay. But there's lots of reasons to believe that this is not the actual number of interest in practice, because there's magnetic fields in galaxy clusters. We can observe them through Faraday rotation of radio sources we see through the cluster. And the magnetic field, at least in the cluster's center, is about 1 to 10 microgauss. Okay. That is probably at most 10-ish percent of the thermal energy density. So it doesn't, probably doesn't dominate the cluster dynamics, but it's plenty strong enough field to really reduce the particle gyro radius to much, much, much less than this number. So going forward, there's more and more interest in trying to simulate galaxy clusters from an MHD perspective, okay, rather than just a fluid perspective. I'm not going to go into much detail on this, but once you add magnetic field into a galaxy cluster, there's interesting physics that can happen regarding temperature gradients and buoyancy. So let me just do cartoon versions of some of that. So one example of a fluid an MHD instability that can happen is in a situation where we have gravity pulling things down. You have a temperature gradient that is increasing as you go into the potential well, and you have a magnetic field that is perpendicular to those gradients. What happens then? Well, if you displace a fluid element up, if it's magnetically connected to its surroundings, it's going to take on, conduction is going to make it take on the same temperature as the rest of this field line. But now you've moved it to a region where the surrounding gas is cooler. And if it's in pressure equilibrium, it's going to be less dense, and it's going to be buoyant, and it's going to start to rise. Okay? So this is an example of an instability that takes a field that's oriented in the tangential direction and starts to pull it into the radial direction. And as you do that, you start also generating turbulence within the cluster. Another, and this is known as the magnetothermal instability. Another kind of instability that you get that's more subtle comes about when gravity is pointing down, the temperature gradient is rising outward, and if we have an oblique perturbation in the magnetic field, I'll exaggerate it here, what you'll get is regions where you have converging field lines, and in those regions, you have conduction that's still happening in this direction, okay? So the temperature gradient is going, you're getting to cooler temperatures going this way. You have conduction down this way. Where the field lines converge, you have extra heating, and that will make this piece buoyant. And where they diverge, you'll have energy being taken away, and that piece will be anti-buoyant. And so you'll take field that is a strong component in the aligned direction, and you'll start to turn it tangential. Okay, these may have big implications for just how the center part of the galaxy cluster is connected to what's going on around the AGN. So this is another area of active research.
How do you model the galaxies, like one particle?
Okay, so that's a resolution-dependent answer. The more resolution you have, the more accurate you think you're being. Often simulations are done where you're choosing the resolution to try to answer the question you want to address. So if you're interested in galaxy evolution in particular, you want to resolve it with lots of particles. Okay. If you are just interested in the the overall energy content of the cluster. Maybe you can get away with galaxies that are not very well resolved at all. And I don't know whether any of the simulators want to comment on this answer. They don't care to. Okay.
Somebody could just put in certain models by hand for a galaxy in more than one particle. Others have the result of
Yeah, it's. I should say, one thing we I found out at this conference is it's still a challenge actually to simulate an entire cluster, a scale of, the universe that's entire cluster size, and do a good job on the characteristics of the central galaxy, to understand its structural properties. So, if I want to back up, if people are interested in understanding the structural properties of individual galaxies, simulate individual galaxies, But if you're interested in the structural properties of a central cluster galaxy, you have to simulate an entire cluster. And that makes it difficult to actually get enough resolution to know what the structural properties of a redis cluster galaxy is from kind of a simulation perspective. Is that a fair statement?
It also requires to solve the cooling flow problem.
Well, yes.
Feedback, right?
Yeah, we got problems. Okay. That's what makes it interesting. But I think it's about time for you to just summarize by indicating where we're going, what's next. I think one reason we're having this conference now is we are entering an era of all sky cluster surveys. So the timing of this is because there's a lot of data rolling in on surveying galaxy clusters throughout much of the volume, observable volume we have available to us. There's an experiment known as the South Pole Telescope, which is at the South Pole. It is a microwave telescope that's looking for clusters by how they scatter their microwave background. It's looking, was originally going to look at about 10% of the sky. It's looking at a little bit less. And one of the results that we heard about at the conference was the most massive cluster in the universe at redshift greater than 1. So far was found by this experiment. And this they'll find a few hundred, maybe 1,000 galaxy clusters this way. There's something known as a dark energy survey. This is, Fermilab has a big stake in this. This is an optical survey, again in the southern sky. They're looking at about a tenth of the sky, looking for galaxies. So finding clusters by finding clumps of galaxies in space. Out to, again, redshift of 1 or so. There's something called eRosita, which is a German-Russian X-ray telescope that should go up in the next 2 or 3 years. It will survey much of the sky, and this one in particular, they hope to find at least 10 to the fifth galaxy clusters. There are surveys on the drawing board, like LSST. And Barnes Synoptic Survey Telescope, which will survey, I don't know whether, how much of the sky will LSST see? Half-ish, and to see lots and lots of galaxy clusters to very deep, So we're going to be getting samples. So a lot of the cosmology that's been done with clusters has been done with something of order hundreds, The game is going to go up to hundreds of thousands in the next decade. And that gives us a lot of statistical power. In order to take advantage of that statistical power, what we need are decent parametric models. I've erased my my cluster physics board. But somehow we have to take what goes on in simulations and come up with efficient parametric models for expressing a lot of the physics that can happen. And at least parameterize some of our ignorance about the subgrid physics, And the hope is that when we fit these surveys to a combined cosmological and cluster physics model, we get constraints on them both. So we learn not only the cosmology, but also get a handle on the astrophysics once we have access to the statistical power of these surveys, And going on to the future, I think right now we do that because computations are still, well, computer sci still prohibits us from simulating the entire sky with all the supernova physics and all the NGN physics and all the MHD. But a decade more of computing power may allow us to make really effective mock skies, is what we call them. Simulations of the entire sky that we can observe as if we would observe for real, and do our cosmology that way without having to resort to the parametric models. So the parametric models, I think, are what we're going to be living with for the next 5 years or so. But more and more, as computing power grows, we're going to be incorporating the rest of this physics and try to make skies as they would be if cosmology and astrophysics were a certain way. So that's what we've been trying to do. And if you have any more questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. Thanks.
Are clusters rotating? Do they have peculiar velocities with respect to each other? Is there any evidence for them having collided in the past? And will a cosmological constant prevent superclusters from forming?
I love your question. So are they rotating?
Buy me something to drink.
All right, I'll see if I can remember them all. Are they rotating? Not so much. There may be some rotation right down at the center, but the reason why galaxies are rotating, or at least this is the way it's supposed to be, is that when you start with a Gaussian random field, anywhere you're sitting, your neighbor's going to exert some sort of torque on you, one direction or another. Okay? So we have our original lumps of matter in space. It's a little bit lumpy. You can estimate how much torque the, your neighboring lumps are going to exert on you, and that gives you a little bit of angular momentum. And then as you collapse, that turns into some rotation. Okay? When you have this big a region of space, a lot of that gets averaged out. Okay, so you don't expect significant rotation on the scale of a galaxy cluster. Your next question was?
Do they have peculiar velocities? And are they
peculiar velocities? There is a way, in principle, to observe peculiar velocities known as the kinetic Semyonov-Zeldovich effect. So I talked about how the hot gas hot electrons can scatter the microwave background. Okay, but if all those hot electrons are moving towards you or away from you, there'll be a net effect that's also a Doppler effect. I don't think has it been unambiguously observed in anything? No. So that's still an observation that hasn't been made yet. We don't expect there to be a lot of motion, again, because you're averaging over such a large size scale. There are attempts to map large cosmic flows, okay, where we do see matter tend to flow into regions where there is more, but I guess the best way to express it, the peculiar velocities we get are considerably less than the velocities within. So maybe a couple hundred kilometers per second for the galaxy cluster compared to 1,000 kilometers per second for the motions within. You had a question about merging. Yes, merging. We see this happen a lot. In fact, that's one of the complications I didn't even get into. When two galaxy clusters merge, there's a lot of kinetic energy released into the cluster and thermal end. Naively, you'd think that would cause the cluster to be unusually hot. And sometimes there are shocks that you observe that are unusually hot. But really, more of the time during the merger process, they're colder than they should be for their mass because it takes time to thermalize all that kinetic energy. And in fact, one of the corrections we need to make to our mass estimates when we do them through X-ray imaging, when you measure the X-ray gas, you can get a mass estimate assuming it's all at hydrostatic equilibrium. But clusters often have residual motions from previous merger events. In fact, little things are falling in all the time. And so we have to correct for that also. So there are mergers. The Bullitt cluster, you might have seen pictures of it, spectacular. That's an unusually powerful one, but yeah. Then there's one on the cosmological constant.
Yeah, will that prevent superclusters?
It is slowing down structure formation as we speak, okay? That's one of the observations we can make with galaxy clusters. We can independently confirm the presence of cosmological constant or something by looking at cluster growth. It's definitely slowing down at a rate that implies that, cosmological constant or something like it is putting on the brakes. And so structure formation is being halted in its tracks. And so the 10 to the 16th stuff will really never get into this state if things go as they are.
Thanks very much.
When you say you can see, this is something you can see now, or it's a future?
This is something we can infer now from the current cluster population. So what you do is you do a Gauss cluster survey. You try to measure how many things there are of each mass at each distance from you. And then that gives you a growth rate for structure. Okay. We see that the growth rate is slowing down. In fact, it was one of the early indications that the matter density was not critical. Okay. The clusters were growing too slowly for that to be the case. Now we can fit it well enough to show that this growth rate is more consistent with a cosmological constant being present than with just not enough matter. Okay. The growth rate, if you measure it, say at a time, growth rate at a time of 6 giga years, it's pretty fast, and now it's slow, and the degree which is slowing down is more consistent with cosmological constant affecting the growth rate than just there not being as much matter.
How accurate is that as compared to other determinations?
In our field, we think it's comparable, it depends on how good a handle we have on all the astrophysics. And we're optimistic, but you know, it's a source of good debate how comparable the constraints are. I think the important thing is what you get from supernova observations is a constraint that is essentially on geometry and expansion rate. It's global dynamics. This is a constraint on dynamics that happens in a much smaller scale. It's an independent measurement. Okay, it's getting at what the properties of dark energy might be from actually how it affects the growth rate of structure, and that's completely independent. And has the potential to indicate whether GR plus dark energy is really the right model when you compare. If you compare supernova and barren acoustic oscillations to structure growth, you can actually test GR.
It's a smaller scale where you can see that.
Well, and it's a smaller, well, it's a, well, yeah, it's a smaller scale, but I think it's quite a different dynamic. Pardon? Yeah, I guess it's one way of looking at it. And it's what's affecting mostly is the contrast between structure growth on small scales and dynamics of the universe as a whole.
Well, it's still very important because we don't have many tests of GR on scales of the
cluster.
We are in the local group. Us. Yeah, so there's Andromeda Galaxy. There's us, and then you know.
Are we in a cluster?
We are on the outskirts of the Virgo cluster. And I think I haven't looked like people used to say eventually we'll fall in and become part of the Virgo cluster. I'm not sure that's true now, depending on the cosmological constant. Does anybody know if we're still destined to fall in the Virgo cluster, whether that's now off the table?
We made a simulation, but we are falling into a Vesuvo.
Okay. So you think we're going to be in there eventually? Okay. So
just to get the time right, so the sun is long gone.
The sun be long gone, yeah. So we're asymptotically part of a galaxy cluster.
Okay, well, that's cheerful.